into some of the details here shortly, but this is lesson 171, kind of the first real one here on BOD 1602, and then we're going to be looking into this one in physical description and content. So let's get right into the introduction. Last week in lesson 170, we concluded our study of manuscript 98. We concluded our study of manuscript 98, the document produced by the Second Westminster Company as they worked on the New Testament epistles. The work recorded in manuscript 98 stands about halfway in the transformation of the Bishop's Bible into what would become the King James. In lesson 162, I stated that we were going to be considering the following points for our main primary work in progress documents, manuscript 98, BOD 1602, and the notes of John Boyce. Those three points were scholarly awareness and published access, number two, physical description and contents, and number three, impact on the readings found in the King James Bible. So we're going to be looking at all three of those. I laid that out that way back now, ancient history, lesson 162. Okay. In lesson 162, we discussed the first of these three points, scholarly awareness and published access with respect to BOD 1602. In summation, we made the following observations regarding this important primary work in progress document. Okay. Now, if I can find my black markers here, we are going to review this point. Now, it has been a while since we talked about BOD 1602 because it took a while to get through the material on manuscript 98. So, what I want to just cover with you now is starting at this point right here, okay? BOD 1602, the Annals of the Bodleian Library, Oxford, edited by William Dunn McCrae, notes the receipt of the volume in 1646, okay? So we're starting today talking about our second document, which is BOD 1602, all right? With respect to BOD 1602, it is noted to be in the possession of the Bodleian Library at Oxford in 1646, okay? So it could have been there sooner, but there's an entry regarding it being there in the Annals of the Bodleian Library in 1646, okay? So I'm just going to say in 1646 it was entered into the library. Whoops. So it's probably, we don't know for sure, it could have been there sooner, but it's noted as being acquired then, okay? Scholarly awareness. 19th century British scholars, B.F. Westcott, General View of the History of the English Bible, 1863, and Nicholas Pocock, the Bishop's Bible of 1568, 1572, and 1602 in the Athenaeum from 1888, wrote about the document but missed its true significance, okay? So in the 19th century, just write these dates up here, okay? In the case of Westcott, it's 1863. And then in the case of Pocock, it's 1888. They write articles talking about, where's Pocock's name? They write articles talking about this document, BOD 1602, but they miss the true significance of the document as a work-in-progress document recording the translator's work as they're doing it. They view it as done after the fact, okay? It was E.E. Willoughby in 1955 who realized that BOD 1602 comprised the draft work of the translators themselves. Willoughby briefly described and discussed BOD 1602 in his 1956 monograph, The Making of the King James Bible, a monograph with comparisons from the Bishop's Bible and the manuscript annotations of 1602 with an original leaf from the Great She Bible. Okay? So I'm going to do it this way. It's 1955-56 when Willoughby figures out what he's really looking at here. So this one is a little bit different than some of the other ones because some people are aware of it in the 19th century, but it's the middle of the 20th century with Willoughby where he figures out what it is he's looking at when he's looking at manuscript 98, okay? And then he writes about it in 1956 in his monograph. Now, if you guys recall, I brought that book in a couple months ago. It's a very large, oversized book. It's not in the best shape, so I don't really want to keep transporting it back and forth between here and church. But he writes about BOD 1602 in 1956, okay? So that's covering now the scholarly awareness, all right? Published access. In 1972, Edward Carney Jacobs presented his doctoral thesis at Auburn University titled A Bodleian Bishop's Bible, 1602, A Preliminary Study of the Old Testament Annotations and Their Relationship to the Authorized Version, 1611. So now we're talking 1972. Jacobs writes a doctoral thesis on this, okay? On this document, 1972, right? A few years later, 1975, Jacobs wrote an essay for the papers of the Bibliographical Society of America titled An Old Testament Copy Text of the 1611 Bible that outlines some of the details of the Old Testament portion of Bot 1602. So 1975 now, Jacobs is going to publish an essay on this in a journal. So 1972 he writes his doctoral thesis, which I have, by the way. I also have an essay from 1975, but the doctoral thesis is obviously not published widely as far as publicly. The journal essay from 1975 is, and then a few years after that, in 1980, just keep going with these notes here, okay? A second essay by Jacobs followed in 1980 for the library titled Two Stages of Old Testament Translation for the King James Bible. So Jacobs is going to now do a second essay in 1980. So we can see that there's, starting with Willoughby, I'm going to put the dotted line here, starting with Willoughby, there becomes an awareness of it, and there starts to be a published access to the document through the writings of Jacobs. Also in 1980, Irina Backus commented heavily on the document in her The Reformed Roots of the English New Testament, The Influence of Theodore Beza on the English New Testament. And then later in 1995, Jacobs co-authored The Coming of the King James Gospels, a collation of the translator's work in progress for the University of Arkansas Press with Ward S. Allen. This important volume provides a complete collation of Bot 1602 with the 1611 text for the Gospels of Matthew through John. So that brings us then all the way to 1995. So the other thing I want to say is that the majority of Jacob's work here in 72, 75, and 80, this stuff is on the Old Testament. The work that Jacobs does in 1985 with Allen, Ward Allen, is focused primarily on the New Testament portion of the document. Okay? So here's the point I want you to see. Scholars knew about it, but didn't recognize its true significance in the 19th century. It's not until the mid-1950s that Willoughby figures out what he's looking at here, and it's going to be even longer than that, almost 20 more years, before somebody finally starts to study it and write about it in any sort of organized way in these journal essays here through Jacobs and the publication of, and his also his doctoral thesis, and it's going to be all the way till 1995 before access to this work is going to be made available through the co-authored work of Jacobs and Allen. So why am I pointing this out? Well, in this same decade here, the 1950s, is when the King James only movement in the United States is going to really pick up steam. Okay? And it's going to, I've said it before and I'll say it again, the train leaves the station during that time frame without any awareness or working knowledge of these primary work in progress documents. Okay? Now, I think that led to a lot of misinformation that was shared and propagated because folks didn't know the information contained in these documents. One big case in point is the idea that they did not follow rule number one, and that they did not use the Bishop's Bible as the base text. That is just patently false, okay? I showed you that with Manuscript 98, and we're going to see pictures here in a few minutes of Bot 1602, which is a 1602 Bishop's Bible with their notes in the margin, okay? So, my point again is that the King James only train in the United States left the station in the 1950s in earnest without a working knowledge of this information. For me, that is extremely important. The information that is in these documents that allow you to look behind the process and see what they were doing. While it does not tell you every jot and tittle of what they were thinking in every case, it does show you the steps in their work in progress and what they were doing. Okay? So, we have discussed scholarly awareness and published access for BOD 1602 and Lesson 162 and 163. So we are now ready to commence our consideration of the following 2 points, those being physical description and contents, and then impact on the readings found in the King James Bible. So it is to a discussion of these points that we will now turn our attention. So if you're just joining us, we're on page 2, and we're about ready to start point number 2, physical description and contents. Before we do that, does anybody have any questions or comments about the introduction? No? All right. So, I first learned about the existence and significance of the document known as BOD 1602 in 2011 when I read A Textual History of the King James Bible by Dr. David Norton. Now, the gentleman who is responsible for giving me this book is sitting here in the audience today, and that would be Craig. Craig read it first. When he read it, he said, "You need to read this. Things are not necessarily how we've been, what we've been led to believe." And at first, I think Craig would agree to this. I was sort of like, I hemmed and hawed, and I was listening to some of the stuff he was saying, and I'm like, that seems a little bit extreme for me. But I agreed I would read the book. As I started reading the book, it became real clear to me real fast what Craig was driving at as far as what the things that he was saying. And I'm like, okay, I didn't know what to do with it, but I knew I had to rethink some stuff, okay? And that's been about a decade-long process, by the way. So, on page 12, Dr. Norton discusses how the King's printer, Robert Barker, furnished the translators with 40 unbound copies of the 1602 Bishop's Bible from which to work. So imagine having loose-leaf, unbound copies, sheets of a Bible printed, and those are going to be the sheets that they're going to work off of and record revisions on. All right, I'll show you that here in a minute. The quote there says, a little is known about how they worked. Robert Barker, the King's printer, supplied 40 unbound copies of a 1602 Bishop's Bible. Barker's actions are completely consistent and expected given Rule 1 furnished by Bishop Bancroft. Quote, "The ordinary Bible to be read in the church, commonly called the Bishop's Bible, to be followed and as little altered as the truth of the original will permit." So are they working off a rule that says they're to revise the Bishop's Bible? So does it make sense then that the King's printer would print 40 unbound copies or loose leaf sheets for the whole Bible for them to work off of as they're doing their work? Okay? As the various companies did their work, revisions to the Bishop's Bible were noted on these unbound sheets. Eventually, these sheets were bound together, creating the document now known as BOD 1602. Any changes to the Bishop's Bible were to be noted on a master copy of the Bishop's Bible itself. Scholars such as Norton believe that BOD 1602 is the closest we can come to a translator's master copy. Okay? So we look at the quote now, top page 3. There is one complete 1602 Bishop's Bible with annotations by the translators, Bodleian Library, Bible, English, 1602, B.1. So that's the official call letters, if you will, on that document if you were to go to the library and ask for it. It is the most important evidence for the King James Bible text outside of the first prints, because it is the nearest we can get to the translator's master copy. Yet it, too, presents major problems for understanding just how the work was done. BOD 1602, as I shall call it, appears now as a finely bound single volume, and there is nothing about its physical makeup to suggest that its sheets did not always belong together. So in other words, if you look at it, there's nothing about it that would tell you that there's anything out of the ordinary about it. It would look like a normal Bible. But when the translators worked on it, it was unbound. The annotations frequently disappear into the fold of the leaf, which would have been impossible if the sheets were already bound. So does everybody understand that, right? So they're working on it, and they're writing over here in the margin, and then eventually do they get bound together, and then does some of the writing disappear into the binding? All right, is basically what he's saying. Consequently, it is possible that Bod 1602 represents not one of the 40 bishops' Bibles supplied by Barker, but a combination of two or more of them. So in other words, it's feasible and probably likely that somebody went around and took up all the sheets that had annotations on them from the different companies and then bound those together, is basically what we're saying here. To my knowledge, Edwin Elliott Willoughby's 1956 monograph, The Making of the King James Bible, contained the first published image of Bod 1602. On page 17, there is a black and white photo of Genesis chapter 1. So I took this photo right out of my copy of the book. Okay? So I'm going to try to make this as big as I can make it. This is a page from a 1602 Bishop's Bible. Alright? Now if you look at this, I'm going to zoom out a little bit, you can see, are there all sorts of annotations in the text and in the margin? Can you see over here that some of those annotations are disappearing into the binding? So the annotations were clearly made on this page before it was what? Bound up. Okay? But we can see here the handwriting notations of this on the page as the 1602 Bishop's Bible now is being transformed or revised into what would become the Bishop's Bible. As far as I know, this image from Willoughby, page 17 of Willoughby, of Genesis chapter 1, is the first published picture of the document that had ever happened. Like, historically speaking, alright? So, folks, this is giving us now a great level of depth and insight into what the translators were doing, how they were conducting their work, etc. Okay? So let's go to the next page. The following is a released image of the document on the Bodleian Library website. And this is of 2 Samuel 17. So I have this called up here. This is the actual Bodleian website. And this is the only image that they have released that I can find on the website. And it's of 2 Samuel chapter 17. So this image here is on the Bodleian website. And as far as I know, this is the only image that they've released. So it's a little irritating to me that they've only released one image. I wish they would have released, I hope at some point they will release all of them so that folks can see them. Now, if you go to the library and you have, I would say, some sort of academic credentials, you can ask for it and look at it. But they are definitely sort of guarding access to it online, right? But we can see the same phenomenon here if we just look at it. So I'm going to go back to the notes because I have a picture of the whole page here. But we can see the same thing here as we sort of zoom in, all right? You can see annotations in the text, and again, you can see them. This would be the fold of the page. Is there writing that's disappearing into the binding? And then there's more annotations out here in the outer margin. If you go to the notes, the next page is a zoom-in on the first seven verses of 2 Samuel, where we can really sort of hone in on what is going on here with the document, and you can see the changes being made in the text, in the margin, as phrases or lines are being canceled out, and then new phrases are being substituted in, etc. So there's a very clear record of what they are revising from the Bishop's Bible and how they are turning it into what would ultimately be the King James. Okay, so that's page 6. Go to page 7 in your notes. Page 7 in your notes, the following images are from the New Testament section of Bod 1602. These are the images that appear on pages 8 and 16 of the coming of the King James Gospels, a collation of the translator's work in progress by Ward S. Allen and Edward C. Carney. And the images are taken from Timothy Berg's essay the revision of the 1602 Bishop's Bible, a.k.a. the production of the King James. So these have a little bit more of a coloration to them, but you can see the same thing. This line has been crossed out. It's been underlined. There's a notation here, the letter B, which then takes you to the margin, which tells you what the substituted language should read. And then once the change is made, it's crossed through and stricken through, indicating that from here on, the reading is now what? What's in the margin. And we'll look at these in detail, but if you look and compare how the 1602 bishops read, so this would be Luke chapter 2, verse 12, this change, the striking of this and the substitution is exactly the way your King James Bible reads in that verse. So what we are looking at is their work in progress revisions as they're making the changes to the text. Okay? And you can really get into, and we will look at this, and understand the process that the scribe is using as they go through and make these changes. All right? And I don't want to bog you down right now in the minutiae of all of that. I'm just wanting you to sort of see the high level view of what it is that we're looking at here. If you go to page 8, that's the second page from Luke 22. So again, unfortunately, the number of images that we can look at are somewhat limited, all right? And I've basically included all of the ones here that I'm aware of are sort of in the public space. So, but the idea or the concept is the same, all right? So let's go to page 9. Anybody have any questions about the pictures? No? All right, page 9. So, writing for the Bodleian Library, the possessors of the document, Helen Moore and Julian Reed, stated the following regarding Bod 1602 in their 2011 publication, Manifold Greatness, The Making of the King James Bible. Quote, three key documents bear witness to the process, that should say whereby the King James Bible was translated. The first is a 1602 copy of the Bishop's Bible, now in the Bodleian Library. At the time of its purchase, was described as, quote, a large wherein is written down all the alterations of the last translation. Okay? So, when they entered into the, in 1646, when they entered into the log of the library, that's the note that they added. The note read, I'll read it again, a large Bible wherein is written down all the alterations of the last translation. That's all it said. Not real detailed, not a lot necessarily to go by. At the beginning of the translation work, 40 copies of the Bishop's Bible were distributed to the companies to act as the basis of the new translation as described in Rule 1. These Bibles were originally unbound and so were handled as loose sheets. The Bodleian 1602 Bible is a bound copy that contains some of the sheets on which manuscript revisions to the Old and New Testaments were marked. It is the only surviving witness to the use made by the companies of these bishops' Bibles, and it refers to the work of four companies. Now let's stop there. This is different from Manuscript 98, okay? Because in the Bodleian document, are they writing the changes right on printed pages of a 1602 bishops' Bible? What we saw with Manuscript 98 was different from that, because it's a separate document that they created, okay? So I just want to call up the image of that again so that the sort of the visual nature of it can strike you. So this is, here's the printed document. We're going to record the revisions right on the document. Manuscript 98, which doesn't seem to be cooperating at the moment, so I'm going to move off it and not wait. Manuscript 98 is a document created to work in conjunction with a 1602 Bishop's Bible, but it's a separate manuscript because it's all written out by hand, as we've already seen. Okay? Moore and Reed comment further as to the nature of the changes exhibited in Bob 1602. Quote, the annotations made to the Old Testament reflect a late state of revision, either as sent to the general meeting in 1610 or as agreed at the meeting, and cover Genesis to Isaiah 4, the first four chapters of Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel, and Hosea to Malachi inclusive. The New Testament annotations relate to the work undertaken by the second Oxford Company of translators and were made by three scribes who handled respectively Matthew and John 17, Mark and Luke 1 through 8, and Luke 19:24 through John 18:21. So there's three different scribes in the gospel section that are scribing different portions of the New Testament text, is what that means. These New Testament annotations comprise three stages of revision and probably took place over the period 1607 to 1610, perhaps after review by the other companies as described in the rules. The annotations in the Bodleian 1602 Bible do not, however, represent the final text of the King James Bible as it was printed. Further revisions were undertaken subsequently. So here's what we still are missing. We still don't have the draft copy that the translators handed to the printer. Okay? Even with all the stuff that we can look at in Manuscript 98 and what we'll see when we look into about 1602, we still don't have sort of the final manuscript or the final record of all the revisions that were made. We don't have what they handed directly to the printer. We don't know. Some surmise that it was burned in the Great London Fire in the middle of the 1600s. We just don't know what happened to it. And we don't know if there ever even was such a precise text created that was handed directly to the printer. Many of these observations were first noted by Willoughby in cursory form with the publication of his monograph in 1956. Willoughby was the first to realize that Bod 1602 was a draft copy of the translator's work in progress instead, here's a key point, instead of an annotated bishop's Bible noting the changes made to the 1602 text by the translators after the fact. So he's the first one to realize that when you're looking at this, you're looking at their revisions being made in real time. It was not something that somebody did after the fact where they sat down on one hand with a 1602 bishops and a 1611 and they're like, okay, well, we're going to backdraft record all the changes. You following the difference? Okay? He says, quote, about this, "This is evident from the manner in which the manuscript annotations of the 1602 Bodleian Bible stand halfway between the 1602 edition of the Bishop's Bible and the 1611 King James Version." Willoughby offered the following examples of proof. Please note that I have retained Willoughby's notes as closely as possible. I have, however, updated the spelling for ease of reading. Let's go look at it, okay? So I'm going to call this up. We're on page 10. So here's the first example noted by Willoughby. Genesis 1:6. "So the bishop's Bible said, 'Let there be a firmament between the waters and the waters.' The manuscript change noted in Bod 1602 says, 'Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters.' And then the 1611 Bible said, 'Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters.'" So, can you see that this was the base, this was the revision recorded in in Bod 1602, which coheres basically with what ends up where? In the 1611, okay? Another one is Genesis 1:11. Bishops, let the earth bring forth bud and green herbs apt to seed, and fruitful trees yielding fruit after his kind, which hath seed in itself." I'm just going to say, that's pretty clunky. Okay? Here's how they wordsmith it in manuscript in Bod 1602. "Let the earth bring forth," this is a shorter way of saying "the," I'm pretty sure, "the bud and herb, it that yields seeds, also fruitful trees, which yields fruit according, which hath each seed in itself." time, which seed is in itself.
Which is the best?
The 1611 reading. So you can see. So do they revise it once and then come back and do more work on it? So Bob 1602 is not the final say, much the same way manuscript 98 for the epistles was not the final say. But does it show us where they were at that point when that change was recorded? Okay? So we got a few. We got Matthew 5. Bishops, if the salt becomes unsavory, that clause is altered in Bob 1602, if the salt becomes savorless, the final reading of the 1611, if the salt have lost its savor. So we can see the changes happening now again in multiple stages of revision. And finally, we can look at Matthew 5. Now understand, these four here on page 10, these four on page 10 are the only four examples that were published until 1975. So Willoughby he realizes what he's looking at, he talks about it briefly, but it is nowhere near a full explanation of the whole thing, okay? And if you wanted more on it, you would have to wait. If you knew about Jacob's doctoral thesis, you could have read about it in 1972, but it's first published in an academic journal in 1975. Before that, the four examples we're going over right now are the only four you would have had out in the public space to really look at, okay? Matthew 5:47, the bishops. What singular thing do ye? Do not also the publicans likewise. That's what the bishops had in Matthew 5:47. Bob 1602. What singular thing do ye? Do not even the publicans so? And then the 1611. What do you more than others? Do not even the publicans so? So again, those are the only examples that are provided there by Willoughby. Okay, let's go to page 11. Any questions before we move on? So the point I wanted you to see, guys, by looking at these examples is Bob 1602 recording their revisions in real time, much the same way manuscript 98 was? And I'm going to make this point a little bit more forcefully later on, but depending on what section of Bob 1602 you're in, you could be either earlier or later in the process of revision. It depends on what section you're in. So, following these four examples, Willoughby states, quote, from these changes, from the readiness of the bishop's Bible to manuscript annotations in the Bodleian copy of the 1602 bishop's Bible to the 1611 King James Bible, it becomes evident that the translators introduced changes which the revisers followed and improved upon. So here, remember we had this discrepancy a while back. So you have, when he's talking about translators, what he's talking about is those people who record the manuscript change. When he's talking about revisers, he's talking about those who came after them and further did what? Revised the change report. Right? That's what he's talking about. That's what Willoughby's talking about when he's using that terminology. So look at that second paragraph of that quote. The annotated Bible, now in the Bodleian Library, it is evident, was not one of the three copies prepared for the revisers. It was rather a copy prepared in advance before all the translation was complete. It records the passages which the translators had changed and had made ready to be revised by the committee of revisers and to print as the 1611 King James Bible. So in other words, what Willoughby is saying is that this is what they handed to the general meeting. The general meeting then worked off of that, and then if they decided they needed to, they made further what? Revision. That's what Willoughby's saying. Now, we got to understand there could be some speculation there, but we need to understand what Willoughby is saying in his comments. So, while it is stated above, we need to be explicitly clear about the nature of the contents of the document. Bod 1602 is a complete 1602 bishops in that it contains the entire Bible from Genesis through Revelation as well as the Apocrypha. So it is a complete Bible. It's got Genesis to Revelation, including the apocryphal section, which we also know the translators did work on. That said, there are portions of the document that contain no annotations. The following list sets forth a table of contents for Bod 1602, noting portions of the Bible, portions of the biblical text, containing the annotations of the translators. Please note that NA stands for not annotated. So I did this to try to help us visualize this. So, in the Old Testament, Genesis 1:1 through Isaiah 4:6 are annotated. Is that a huge chunk of the Old Testament? Okay. However, Isaiah chapter 4 verse 6, I'm sorry, verse 7, through the end of Isaiah have no annotation. I don't know why, but they don't. They're not, there's no annotations in that part. Jeremiah chapter 1 verse 1 through Jeremiah chapter 4 verse 31 have annotations. Jeremiah chapter 5 verse 1 through 52:34 and Lamentations have no annotations. It's not annotated. Ezekiel 1:1 through 4:17 have annotations. Ezekiel 5:1 through 48:35 have no annotations. Daniel 1:1 through Daniel 4:37 have annotations. Daniel's chapters 5 through 12 have no annotations. Hosea chapter 1 verse 1 all the way to the end, all the way to Malachi chapter 4 verse 6, basically the end of the Old Testament, have annotations. The apocryphal section has no annotations. Matthew chapter 1 verse 9 through Luke chapter 24 verse 53 have annotations. John 1:1 through John 15 have no annotations. And then all of a sudden, John 16:1 through 21:25 have annotations again. And then there are no annotations except for a very few in Acts through Revelation, but they are largely and mostly unannotated or have no annotations. Okay? Any questions? In his doctoral thesis, Jacobs catalogs and describes 32 different marginal textual signs used in the Old Testament portion of Bod 1602. According to Jacobs, quote, all of the signs are of one general size, usually about 1/6 to 1/8 of an inch. The following general comments are made about the practices of the annotator. Quote, the annotator makes all revisions intended for a given recto or verso of a leaf on the recto or verso. So you're like, what does that mean? That's this, okay? I can't remember which. Recto, I think, is this, the right side. Verso would be the left side. So if he's annotating 2 Chronicles, what is this, 17 I said? Mm-hmm. 2 Chronicles 17, verse 1, he's going to put the annotations for that right on that page. All right? He does not, for example, record revisions meant for A4 on A5. The annotator is careful to record all revisions for a given verse either in the text of the verse or in the outer marginal space adjacent to the verse. The annotator is careful never to write annotations in the upper, top, or lower bottom margins. Occasionally, a revision for a top line or bottom line will violate its boundaries, but it is apparent where the revision belongs. One never encounters a revision written in the head margin that belongs to a verse midway in the column below. For revisions performed within the text, the annotator is usually careful not to violate the double rules that separate the two columns of the text on the page, nor to write textual revisions belonging to the outer column in space belonging to the inner column. So in other words, if he's revising this column, where does he write the mark? Where does he write the annotations?
To the left.
To the left. If he's revising this column, he writes them where?
To the right.
If he's revising something at the top, he doesn't put the notes where? At the bottom, or vice versa. Occasionally, the annotator will trespass his boundaries by a letter or two, or a short word, but again, it is apparent where the annotation belongs. In the use of the textual marginal signs, the annotator carefully avoids confusion. In the Old Testament, Though the order of the signs suggests no implicit meanings, and though the same signs can and do appear several times on the same page, the annotator is careful not to employ any one sign or pair of signs more than once in any given verse, excepting, of course, the caret sign. So sometimes, we're going to see this in detail next week, sometimes he just puts a little caret sign like that. So this would be the text, okay? And then there would be a caret sign in the margin indicating that whatever he wants to see here, he's recorded it where? There. Other times he uses like this little half moon with a strike over the top. And then in the margin there's a half moon with a strike over the top, indicating this change goes with this what? This spot. So it's important to note that in the case of the Old Testament portion of Bob 1602, the textual annotations appear to have been made by a professional secretary. Craney. Jacobs covers this in his 1975 essay, An Old Testament Copy Text for the 1611 Bible. Jacobs also believes that the same secretary is responsible for all the Old Testament annotations, quote, "The annotator's hand in the Old Testament is a secretary hand. This hand was much in use between 1525 and 1650. By 1700, however, it was no longer a distinct hand." So what he means by that is this guy's a professional what? Secretary using what would appear to be a professionally trained methodology for noting the revisions within the text. Certain of the annotator's letters, such as the letter H, have a minor infralinear descender. Good to know that. Immediately identify the hand as a secretary hand. Such habits as the annotator's constant use of the tittle, his use of certain constructions for such words as the. See, I mentioned this before, right? Sometimes the word the will be written out shorthand like this. I don't understand why, but that's the way they would do it. With which, his use also of distinctive contractions and terminal constructions. These and other of the annotator's habits are common to the secretary hand. The annotator's habits of spelling and punctuation also help to date the hand as a 16th or early 17th century one. It is difficult to determine whether more than one annotator has been employed in the labor of recording these annotations. Excepting a few instances in Genesis 2, the annotations show a close similarity in their letter formations. Certain characteristics of the annotator's hand appear throughout all the annotations. Frequently, the annotator leaves his minuscule as, so A-S and O-S, open at the top. Likewise, he frequently leaves the curved base of his minuscule A-S unclosed at the top. So in other words, are there distinctive features of the handwriting that indicate the same person is doing all of the annotating, using this professional secretary hand? The annotator pays little attention to the simplest matters of punctuation. The most disconcerting, right? Yeah. The most disconcerting of all is this habit of writing several words in succession with no lift of the pen to provide a break between words. Moreover, the examination that I present below of the consistent method by which the annotator has recorded these annotations argues strongly for the existence of only one annotator at work. Now, it's clear, he's talking about the Old Testament here. When we get to looking at the New Testament, it's clear there are at least three different hands in the Gospel annotations. We'll get to all that later on. The situation with the New Testament portion of Bob 1602 is different as New Testament section portion of Bob 1602 is different as reported by Ward S. Allen and Edward Jacobs in The Coming of the King James Gospels, a collation of the translator's work in progress. Quote, "The Bible's New Testament annotations are our present concern. The evidence which follows, handwriting, methods of annotation, and textual collation, argues that three scribes were responsible for recording the New Testament annotations. The evidence reveals, moreover, the presence of three causally related stages of translation, which occurred sometime between 1607 and 1610. That the various sections of Vav 1602 represent different stages in the revision process is almost universally recognized by those who have studied the document. Simply stated, the Old Testament annotations are believed to represent a later stage, whereas the New Testament annotations are believed to represent the work earlier in the process. We will be considering each section in this class. In the next lesson, we will consider the Old Testament section of Vav 1602 specifically. So this particular lesson, guys, was just about laying out the physical features, contents, and descriptions of what is in the document, what the annotations are like, and what we should be expecting as we continue to go forward, okay? So we are done, and we do have time to spare, which is a rarity around here. So does anybody have any questions or comments about anything presented in the lesson?
When the 1602 Vav was a committee in charge of the revision, or was one or two people in charge of that to go to the printers? Or?
So,
I don't have a lot of space to write. So, late in the process, 1610, you have the general meeting. Okay? At the general meeting, 12 men, two from each company, review the whole thing. It's out of this that whatever they send to the printer, that the final, that the first issuance of the 1611 comes out. Okay? This document here is not whatever fills in that gap. And the way we know that is, yes, for as many revisions as are recorded here, they're not final because further changes were made after, right? So whatever document fits into this gap here between what they did here and what was printed here, we don't have it.
And we don't know how many
people. What we do know is that two translators, Miles Smith and a guy named Bilson, who's not listed, but there's extra documentation to suggest that these two guys see the thing through the press. Does that make sense? But whatever the document is here that fills the gap, we don't know for sure. We don't have it, number one. Number two, I don't think anybody knows for sure what it was or what it looked like or what form it took. But we don't have it. We don't know what it was. Okay? What this document was somebody went around to all the companies, collected up all of their unbound sheets, and bound them together. And then this ends up in the Bodleian Library. But this document here, Vav 1602, is not this missing document.
It's close to it. It's probably as close to it as we're going to get as far as what's extant that we know about right now, but it's not the final record of all of the revisions as they left the final meeting, the general meeting before it was printed.
Second question, did the king have any influence that we know between that and the printing in 1611?
We don't know for sure. We don't know for sure what the king looked at. We also don't know what Bancroft may or may not have inserted influence over. We just don't know. So I'm not going to stand here and speculate and say stuff that we can't prove through documentation. It's possible. We don't know.
But what we do know is the king never, like, officially authorized it or gave it his stamp of approval or anything like that. It's just go through the process and then all of a sudden there it is in 1611. Okay, now we can also know that it is Miles Smith who wrote the preface, And it is believed that Smith and Bilson are the ones that are responsible for all of the stuff like these headings, the chapter summaries at the beginning of chapters, all of those sorts of things. That's what is customarily believed about it. I don't know that that could be proven definitively. Any other questions?
I have two.
Yeah.
One, and you kind of alluded to it, is there any, and I don't know if they can determine this based on the way it was bound or whatever, indication as to when it was bound? It sounded like you said it was bound prior to being recorded in 1646.
It was definitely bound before that.
Okay.
So at some point, subsequent to the general meeting in 1610, and when it shows up in the library in 1646, it was bound.
So they felt it was a matter of record worth putting the effort.
It seems that somebody felt like this was worth the time, a matter of record, even though when it's finally entered here, there doesn't seem to be too much care about it. But somebody, yes, thought we should gather up all these loose sheets and bind them. Now, what that tells me then, though, is that there was probably more than one of these floating around. There's the one that we have, as incomplete as the annotations are, like I showed you, but somewhere there was record of more revisions even than that.
The second question was relative to the annotations, those big squats that did not have any. It's probably likely, or maybe there's some speculation as to why those squats were not there, but maybe there were other documents that had those parts filled in, and it just happened that this copy didn't because the notes from the other parties were in another document.
That could be conceivable, and probably likely. It seems to me that this speaks to some sort of a duplicate to what was sent to the general meeting. But again, there's an element of speculation in that I can't escape, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So if there was no annotation there, it followed the bishop's file.
Well, no. It's not like this was manuscript 98, right? And this was blank. So that indicated a verse where they just were going to move forward the bishops. That doesn't mean that in these sections, Bart, where there are no annotations, that they just accepted the bishops without revision. It just means that in Bod 1602, there are no recorded revisions. But they were revised. These sections were revised. There are revisions of which are just not recorded in Bod 1602. Does that make sense? All right, anybody else with a question? Now look, guys, if the King James only train is leaving the station in earnest in the mid-1950s, and it's leaving the station without any awareness, much less working knowledge of what these documents tell us, in my mind, it's no wonder that things were said in defense of the King James that weren't true. Now, some people think that I am over-exaggerating the importance of the primary work in progress documents. They can think what they want. I don't think I am. I think that these are as close as we're ever going to get to looking at what are they changing. Now, I will admit that they are not telling us in every case why they're making those decisions, but it's giving us way more to go off of than we've ever had before. Okay? Any other questions or comments before we close? So next Sunday, we're going to look at some lessons where we're going to actually zoom in and look at some of the revisions that are made to certain. Now, obviously, we can't do it for this whole thing, just like we couldn't do it for every verse in manuscript 98. But we're going to look at enough so that you can get the flavor and the sense of what was going on. Alright? Alright, well, appreciate your attention. It's kind of bad weather a little bit this morning. Appreciate all you guys making it out. I'm going to go ahead and close down the stream. If you have any questions or comments after, stick around while we clean up. Appreciate your